Thank you, Madhir. Okay, so we are now ready for the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for Halloween, the 31st of October, 2018. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis, facilitating, Craig McKee, secretary. And Craig, are you ready to call it off?
Yeah, sure. I have Craig McKee, Richard Elifritz, Barbara Honegger, Richard Gage, Cheryl Curtis, Frank Tlopko, John O'Malley, Peter Ketchum, Ken Freeland, and Paul Zaremka. And I'm just checking to see if anybody new's come on. Okay, that's who we have so far.
Okay, anybody not hear their name mentioned that's on the call? Can I ask who the 516 number is, please? 516, who would that be?
That would be me, Richard Elifritz.
Richard, okay. Thank you, Richard. Okay. All right. So we've got done. Then let's move on to approving the minutes from the last meeting. Craig, did you ever send me the corrected version of the previous meeting with the amendment?
I can't remember off the top of my head. I'd have to check. I thought I had at the time. I thought I did it sort of the...
Well, I know you did it the previous month, but I don't think I remember getting it for this last month. So you might check it out if you have it. Please resend it. Otherwise, send it.
Okay. All right. Then I'll do that. Do you recall what the change was that had to be made?
Yeah. There was one person was not included in the roll call. Yep. Present.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. I'll make sure that I'll get that to you.
Okie doke. So, is there any amendment to the minutes for this past month? Not as circulated on the draft agenda because I did not have it in hand at the time I published the draft agenda. But Craig did circulate it on the internet. So, borrowing from that, anybody want to amend those minutes? Okay, hearing no requests to amend, we'll take the minutes for approved and move on to tonight's draft agenda, as circulated by me. So if anyone has a comment or an amendment to offer to the draft agenda, please speak now.
Ken, this is Cheryl.
Yes,
I just wonder, do you have Robert Fitrakis is supposed to be on as a third speaker, and I didn't see him on the agenda, and I didn't know if that had been added. So
that was, I believe I added that, didn't I, Cheryl?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't see that one. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Just checking.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments on the agenda before we proceed to adopt it for tonight's use? All right, and hearing none, we'll take the draft agenda for our use tonight and move on to the first item on the agenda. That would be the 9/11 Truth and its debunkers, and that would be our guest Richard Elifritz, and Craig will introduce him. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay. Thank you. Well, yeah, Richard Elifritz, PhD, is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of the Bahamas. He's associate editor of Communications and the New Tools of Power, a member of the Working Group on Propaganda and the War on Terror, and an ordained clergy person in the Church of Spiritual Humanism. Richard will be talking to us about a subject that he has formally studied for several years, the discourse within the 9/11 Truth Movement and between the movement and its counter-movement, particularly with respect to World Trade Center 7. And he'll also address the use of the conspiracy theory label to suppress truth. So I, without any further ado, I'll pass it over to Richard, and we'll hear from him. Richard?
Oh, okay, well, happy Halloween, everybody, and thank you for letting me join the conversation. I've been meaning to be on one of these conference calls sooner or later, so very happy to be here discussing my work. I guess a little bit of background about the work. I, as any PhD student has to do, I had to develop a dissertation, and I had been looking and researching more and more into 9/11, 9/11 truth, and decided that this was an understudied topic in the field, and that where it had been studied by academics, there was a nearly complete disservice or just outright disingenuous treatment of the 9/11 truth movement and sort of the understanding of the events of September 11th that had been generated by some of the movement's key members, like David Ray Griffin, Richard Gage, and various academics like Paul Zaremka. And so I had a very supportive advisor on my side who had studied the Exxon Valdez oil spill and sort of had dealt with some interesting politics and in that regard. And so, you know, some people have asked me how, you know, basically they've asked me how did I get away with writing such a dissertation as this? And, basically I was very much encouraged and steered to in the direction of making it as sociological as possible. So, you know, if you ever kind of look through my work, which I'm using as the basis of my, my presentation tonight, it's just, you know, completely packed with sociological and technical jargon that I wanted to use to, as much as possible, legitimate my contrary notions on what's kind of typically accepted as the truth of this of September 11th. That is that the United States was an innocent nation. 19 Muslim terrorist hijackers from Al Qaeda, guided by Osama bin Laden, initiated a surprise attack and hit 75% of their targets. So that's kind of what I treat as the orthodox claim that's set out by an official authorized account in the Zelikow 9/11 Commission report. And so, you know, pretty much the project that I engaged in to complete my dissertation, you know, was done with sort of the understanding that it could rock the boat. It could be seen as illegitimate on its face. And sort of the, you know, incidentally, that's primarily what I was addressing was the legitimacy of truth claims about the events of September 11, 2001. So, you know, kind of what I thought I'd do is just give, you know, generally sort of the sociological approach to studying the social world and then take you a little bit through my work, just kind of discuss what I'm doing currently and where I plan to go with it in the future. So, actually, in the last chapter of my dissertation, I kind of describe one of the guiding ethos of sociology, and that's to debunk common social myths. So a lot of sociologists sort of, you know, establish themselves as myth busters and debunkers. So I figure that, you know, that is a good way to head into this for other sociologists to sort of understand what it is that I'm doing. I'm critically interrogating what has been said about the events of September 11, 2001, with an attention to the discourse. So discourse isn't just about what people talk about, but it's what we write about, the images, the sort of stories or narratives, and including the myths that are generated about events, processes, people, and even ideas. So sociology is the systematic study of social behavior and society. Anything that involves two or more people is fair game for sociological analysis. Sociology has a rich tradition in critical analysis that assumes that society is composed of competing groups that are engaged in conflict over scarce resources. And so one of the scarce resources that exist is sort of the dominant paradigm or sort of the consensus opinion on the way the world works. So you might think in like, you know, medieval Europe, the Catholic Church had hegemony over the dominant paradigm. So most people would subscribe to the ideologies generated there. Just to kind of point out how this works, in the title of my work, I use the term deniers instead of debunkers. Because after evaluating what it is that the quote-unquote debunkers do, I decided that actually what they do is they deny. Because if they truly debunked, which sometimes they do, they'll put to rest sort of the more, you know, maybe what we might consider far-out claims. But typically what these quote-unquote debunkers, self-styled debunkers, do is they deny the truth claims of members of the 9/11 truth movement. And, you know, one of the things I say is that's what they do. They deny, deny, deny. So that language actually comes out of my background in environmental sociology. So I studied under a professor who studied climate change skepticism. And so there was a big debate among these environmental sociology scholars of what to call these people. Are they climate change skeptics? Are they denialists? Are they deniers? And that's sort of where I was leaning with that term as well. And then somebody's informed me that, you know, there's also Holocaust deniers. And I think maybe for people who kind of share the skepticism toward the official authorized accounts, that, you know, the 3,000 people who died on that day, plus the hundreds of thousands or millions more who have died as a result of the war on terror, is a type of Holocaust. So to deny sort of the truth claim that World Trade Center 7 collapsed at near freefall acceleration or at freefall acceleration indicates that there was something other than what was reported by NIST or FEMA or the 9/11 Commission report, is to deny that sort of that mass murder incident. So when that word debunker gets used, that's part of that official discourse that guides thinking about our relationship to sort of what might be called the truth value of 9/11. And so I use 9/11 discursively. 9/11 is just a phrase that can indicate so many different things for different types of people. The events of September 11th are objectively different. Those are actually what occurred. And I kind of highly doubt that any one single individual knows the capital T truth of every event that happened. But people generally have some broad idea, you know, more or less informed by details and facts and myths about quote unquote 9/11. And so when we talk about like 9/11 debunkers, I think we're falling into the trap of sort of the legitimacy that debunkers have in society. You know, the debunker's job is to say, and please don't take me having a stance on these any one way or the other. The debunker's job in society is to say, no, you actually can go swimming within 45 minutes of eating food or something along those lines. Like, no, there's no Loch Ness monster or something like that. So I just think that using that word debunkers is sort of even falling into the trap of the 9/11 truth movement's counter movement. So in discussing the 9/11 truth movement, I just consider it as sort of any typical social movement that's out there. In fact, it appears at the top of the list on Wikipedia's list of social movements. You know, you wouldn't find the 9/11 truth counter movement on the list because a social movement is a more or less coherent network of individuals, groups, and organizations that have generally the same agenda. And so there will be discourse within the movement about, you know, like, for example, you'll see people saying, well, debating the physics of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is a moot point because it doesn't push our agenda forward of achieving, you know, some type of institutional change in policy. So that'll be like internal discourse to the movement. But the movement counter-movement dynamics include sort of what is said about the movement in society generally. So the counter-movement is a loosely coupled network of people who at one time or another and for one reason or another oppose the agenda of the 9/11 truth movement. So what I did in my study was I collected what I thought was a sort of a more or less representative example of counter-movement claims, and this included Jonathan Kay's book, Among the Truthers, which is where I got part of my title from. So I kind of wanted to interpolate him. I was hoping to draw him into my conversation by calling it Discourse Among the Truthers and Deniers of 9/11. I used Popular Mechanics' first and second edition of their, you know, quote unquote debunking book. And then I used various articles from philosophers and psychologists and journalists to sort of just show how this movement counter movement discourse operates. In my work is again, it's like full of social theory and just kind of ways to explain social movements. So I explain social movements in terms of antagonists and protagonists. And one way to think about this whole thing is that what the deniers want to do is establish themselves as the protagonists of the story of 9/11. They want to defend society against, you know, we paranoid, crazier, or otherwise kind of wrong thinking people. So for example, you know, a book that was just released last month was Mick West's Escaping the Rabbit Hole. So this is sort of one of the most active deniers out there, and I've had several interactions with him and am planning on in the future writing some material in response to him. Let's see. So backing up, where was I? So you get people out there who are more or less motivated to sort of directly or indirectly engage with our claims. Like Mick West would be one of these people who's directly engaging with us. So was Jonathan Kay. So was Popular Mechanics. And I just so what I wanted to do was, when I studied them, I wanted to study like the consistency or the origins or the application of their arguments. So one argument that's put forward among, you know, among half a dozen or a dozen or so is that we sort of just play we feign innocence. And in fact, one of these people, Aronovich, said it's a violent innocence. So these are the self-styled protagonists protecting society against our violent innocence of just asking questions. And actually they call them socially disturbing questions. And that's kind of the point, is that these people posit themselves as the rational adults in the room, and we're just the sort of unruly children who don't really understand how the world works. We have, you know, flawed epistemologies, or we spread lies and misinformation, and they say that the reason that this is important to study is because we're going to convince people that climate change isn't real, or that it's unsafe to vaccinate your children, or that we're going to convince people to not vote. So they really do think of themselves as the protagonists in the story, protecting society from we antagonists. So the other side of that, to sort of invert this whole thing, obviously the 9/11 truth movement would be the protagonists, and we're sort of, you know, fighting the boogeyman or the monster, or however you kind of want to put it, whatever this, and like, I like to use the analogy to Stephen King's It, like this sort of amorphous thing that changes its shape depending upon kind of what its target is, and it relies upon fear, right? So this is the thing that we're battling. It's not just whoever or whatever was able to pull, you know, to devise the event, to carry out the event, and to cover up the event, and then to utilize the event for the war on terror. It's also the various network of defenders of the official authorized version. So kind of just in a broad brush sense, that's the way that I'm thinking about social movements when I discuss this type of stuff in my research. So my data come from interviews with 9/11 truth activists in Manhattan on the memorials during 2011, 13, 15. I was in Washington, D.C. in 2017, helping distribute literature for the Bobby McElvain Act, collecting some interviews. I went back to Manhattan this year, so I have plenty of interviews, just hours and hours of interviews with dozens and dozens of people. I've spent years in the 9/11 Truth Movement Facebook group and various other Facebook groups dedicated to 9/11 truth. And you know, I'm fairly familiar with the quote unquote debunking material. So one of the things that they our counter movement say that we do is we're just asking questions. So I go through my analysis section of my dissertation. And I just kind of show how, well, first of all, they just kind of cherry pick the questions that they say that we're asking. Like, it's not like they had some social scientists like myself out there sort of asking what are called grounded questions. So just very kind of vague general questions that allow the participant to say whatever they want. They always just kind of cherry pick what it is that they say we say. So first of all, that's unscientific. You wouldn't do that in my field and get away with it very soon. Even Jonathan Kay came out and said that his work was unscientific. And incidentally, it gets cited in the scientific literature by psychologists, you know, as if it has some type of validity or legitimacy to it. And so then I go through and I say, and I show sort of missed opportunities that, you know, they could have focused on the empirical questions that we ask about the collapse of the buildings and things of that nature, but they kind of choose to focus more on rhetoric. And then they do a disservice in even showing that, for example, you know, one distortion was that, well, we ask, like, why was Bush still in the classroom? What was he doing? What, you know, what was his part in all of this? And they, you know, forget to mention to the readers that that question was originated in the Family Steering Committee, right? And so it's all these kind of like little tactics and strategies to just consistently distort what it, you know, the discourse within the movement, or they cherry pick and sort of straw person, you know, certain statements that members or organizations, you know, say and do. So, you know, an example of this was that in between Popular Mechanics, first and second editions, David Ray Griffin's book on World Trade Center 7 came out, but they didn't cite it. So, you know, like somebody like a Rachel Maddow can hold up Popular Mechanics books, you know, book and say, this is the best debunking material out there. And then I come along and say, well, if it was the best and if it was rigorous, then why didn't it address A, David Ray Griffin's response to their book, or B, ostensibly what generated the second edition of their book, which was, you know, the sort of problematic unfolding of how to explain the collapse of World Trade Center 7. So that's, you know, kind of in a nutshell, my approach to the movement, counter-movement dynamics is, first of all, I have to be a sociologist and think scientifically and rigorously and methodically. And then second of all, as a movement member, like, I know that most, or not, I don't know about most, but I know that World Trade Center 7 is a talking point for most movement members and even the main point of some of the organizations. And so, you know, that I chose to focus on that particular building as the sort of the central claim, and then just see how it's treated by the counter movement in relation to what I know that movement members talk about and discuss, you know, during real world activism or their online activism. So that, you know, really, if you ever take a look at my work, I would just say, like, go kind of straight to chapter 4, which is the chapter where I really just kind of highlight the empirical statements that are made about the movement, and sort of, you know, then I use just quotes and information to say, like, yeah, that's a distortion. And then what I would like to do in the future is I really want to collect systematically the sort of anti-conspiracist narratives about how allegedly or supposedly conspiracy theorists think. And then I just want to see if they hold up the scrutiny in terms of the data that I've collected over the last 7 years. And, you know, I've been doing this long enough and to know that, you know, out of all the tactics that they say that we use, so they say that we're the ones that cherry pick and we're the ones that use straw person or red herring or, you know, other rhetorical fallacies. And I can show in just about all of those instances that that the counter movement or, you know, the anti-conspiracists, quote unquote debunkers, also use those things. So if that's their explanatory framework, then either they're conspiracists too, or that explanatory framework explains so much that it explains nothing. And then I think with I'm sort of waiting on Dr. Halsey's study to be finalized. Maybe a couple other things. I want to see where the Bobby McElvain Act goes, and that'll sort of help me kind of wrap up or you know tie the bow on this large package that I've been moving towards for several, quite a few years now. So, I mean, with that, I know that was kind of like a fast-paced, nutshell, broad brush version. Be happy to take any questions. And honestly, I would appreciate a back and forth. I know I've talked to some of the people in this group. I'm looking forward to talking to other people. And I would just like to say that I really admire the work that everybody's doing.
Okay. Well, that was a very dense kind of presentation. There was a lot of meat in it, and I'm sure there is going to be some responses and questions here. So Let's go into question and answer mode here, and we'll proceed to give folks an opportunity to ask Dr. Alfritz a question or make a comment. Wrong button. Let's try that again. So, if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, star 6 will put you in the queue. And in the meanwhile, I would just like to say I was very impressed, particularly with the nomenclatural aspect of your work, Dr. Alfritz, because I think it was Confucius said something to the effect that if you want to change the world, start calling things by their proper names. And it's very clear that when you allow somebody to call himself your debunker, that you're giving him sort of leeway to say there's bunk there to be debunked. There's bunkum. So it's a good point. It's an excellent point, and one that I think serves us well to dwell on. Okay, let's go to Frank Colacco first. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, Frank here. Dr. Alfritz, can you hear me?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hello? Dr. Alfritz is muted. One moment. Let me get him back his microphone.
Hello?
Okay.
Hello?
Yes.
Dr.
Alfritz. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just call me Rich, everybody, please.
Okay.
Okay, Rich, can you hear me?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, yeah. Frank Filipko from Massachusetts. I was very intrigued when I saw the draft agenda that you would be on it. In fact, I went back and looked at some of the work that you did. I actually read parts of your doctoral thesis, skimmed other parts. And one thing that sort of struck me was between the deniers, as you call them, and the truthers, as other people call us, in some cases, they're united on a given issue, not necessarily dealing with 911. And so there are people in part of the denier group that debunk the moon landing, as well as people within the 9/11 truth movement to do the same thing. So they're sort of united. That also goes for vaccinations, Holocaust denial, etc. How do you deal with that? In other words, they're united on some way, but they're really separate on the whole idea of 9/11 truth.
Yeah, and let's see. Throughout my just to kind of think logically in terms of my own work, you could draw a big circle around both groups and find several commonalities. So most of us, I don't know, speak English or we're citizens of a nation state. We'll have common conversations about holidays or whatnot, right? So yeah, I would just assume that. You might find Holocaust deniers within either group. I would totally be willing to bet that out of both groups, you'd be more likely to find them within 9/11, the truth movement, as opposed to quote unquote debunkers or deniers. Like the moon landing, the vaccinations and things like that. What I would do methodologically is I would find the purists. And so these are people who are sort of the active defenders of all that is true according to them. And so these are people like Michael Shermer, Jonathan Kay, Mick West, and maybe the people at Popular Mechanics. These would be the sort of like the ultimate gatekeepers, and they tend to just kind of go after anything that is not approved by official discourse. And one sort of method that they use to sort of, give themselves credibility as debunkers is they'll sometimes say, well, conspiracies do happen. So there was the Iran-Contra affair and there was Watergate. I see this come up again and again and again. So, routinely I'll see in the anti-conspiracist literature, well, there's always a kernel of truth in the heart of every conspiracy theory. And so you got these kind of two things going on. Which is one, you'll see a commonality among, and I'll just call them debunkers for ease. The debunkers will kind of admit, yeah, okay, conspiracies do happen, but we know which conspiracies have happened, and they all tend to follow a certain pattern or style. And since we say that 9/11 doesn't operate like that, it's not a real conspiracy. So that allows them to sort of have a little bit of, I guess, credibility and I guess, logic by saying, like, those types of things. And then you get people, like, within the 9/11 Truth Movement who you know, they'll defend, for example, Mick West being in the 9/11 Truth Movement group because he debunks more of the far-fetched theories about what happened on the events of September 11. Now, I'm sort of refraining from even speaking towards those things because the problem is that due to the fact that there are so many competing explanations about a variety of events, as you said, vaccines, the moon landing, Holocaust, you know, there's even people who in the 9/11 Truth Movement who believe that the Earth is flat. So I kind of refrain from even speaking to those things right now. Because they're divisive issues. And then you have this other side of the story, which is to say that some people within the movement will try to call others out for not being purists to the degree that they want. So if you're a 9/11 truther, that's fine. But if you also don't believe that the moon landing was a hoax, or you also don't believe, you know, something else, well, you just don't know the full truth. And then there's this debate that goes on simultaneously, which is about the productivity. You know, so some people say, well, that's why we should just focus on World Trade Center 7 or something like that. But then other people will say, well, no, because that's too narrow, and you need to focus on, you know, on all these other events. And for me as a sociologist, I sort of have to take a step back here and just say, that's interesting. I'll note that and I'll take note of it and try to explain it the best I can. But as an activist, I mean, it's difficult to deal with, you know, and I think that just sort of as a human being and, you know, like spiritually, I think that ultimately we need to find our commonality among, you know, our brothers and sisters on the planet. And so, if and when the truth outs and there's still people defending the official authorized version, you know, we know that they're sort of not on our side, or, you know, they're I don't know, they don't have a good grasp of reality, but that's what we're fighting over. We're fighting over the definition of reality. And okay. And I think, yeah, so that's kind of what I think.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Next is Cheryl. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I was just wondering, have you found any connection, like with Jonathan Kay or people like that, to the intelligence community? I don't know if your research goes in that direction, but I just wondered if you had any evidence on where, you know, who they were working for. Are they just these independent guys?
That is the question, isn't it? Is, you know, who are these people? What's motivating them? You know, yeah, so like Jonathan Kay, I'm told it has close ties to the Mossad. He authored a fictional book called, I think it's called The Volunteer. And, you know, it sort of speaks to some type of relation. And I know he defends the organization. I also know that he has said things like, well, I wish I was getting paid by the CIA because, you know, I'd like them to supplement my income. But this is something that you kind of see, you know, a lot of the debunkers say is that, yeah, we wish we were getting paid because that would be nice. And so that's kind of one way of deflecting the question. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is there was a group on Facebook called 9/11 Truthers Are Crazy. And they eventually put as their banner something along the lines of, you know, when in doubt, play the 9/11 shill card or something like that. So they end up even using that kind of that question about professional affiliation to intelligence agencies or being an asset of them as a way to say, that's just another symptom of your paranoia.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul Zaremka's next. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. Hi, Rich. It's Paul Zaremka. I have a question, maybe kind of difficult, I don't know, but you've been talking to lots of people, so I'm, that's what I'm focusing on. Trump 2 days ago said that the stock market opened the day after 9/11 in order to motivate him going to Indiana after what happened in Pittsburgh. And then just a couple of hours ago or a day ago, He had another just straight out lie when he says that the United States is the only country which gives citizenship to people who are born in the country, when it's even false for Canada and Mexico, let alone many other countries. So what I'm concerned with is the lack of interest, or the lack of concern for truth. And I don't mean truth in a capital T sense. I mean struggling for truth. I mean, none of us have the truth. We struggle for the truth, or better truth, or whatever you want to call it. But you're talking to a lot of people, and I'm wondering if you have any success or any kind of insight about how people think about truth, or I don't know. My question is not even very well formulated, but maybe you get an idea of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I think I have a pretty good idea. And that's actually something that's been on my mind for a long time, namely because truth is right in the middle of the 9/11 truth movement. And that's what we're struggling over is that, we want the truth of the events, right? And what we're saying implicitly and many times explicitly is that the general public does not have the truth of those events. So this will be like the one of the main claims is, did you know that a third building fell on 9/11? Now, I think that claim is not, that claim isn't about truth. It's about ignorance. It's about this idea that, did you know, like you might be lacking knowledge. And so that now that you do have a knowledge that it's true that a third building collapsed, like now, what do you think about those events and your thinking of those events? What do you think about your own thinking and how you used to think?
Right.
Let's see. In my field, we have a very important concept called the definition of the situation, or sometimes it's called the Thomas theorem. And so that the kind of definition is that if people define a situation as real, the situation will become real in its consequences. And so there are organizations and institutions, so namely, mass media, news media, government, corporations, that are all struggling sort of over the definition of reality, right? So in science, we would like to believe sort of has a more direct connection to an objective assessment over what reality is. But many of us know that there are problems with the peer review process. There are peer-reviewed papers that look scientific, but they are based on bad data, falsified data. They're outright hoaxes. So I, with that in mind, with this idea that like of hoaxes being generated on purpose to purposefully deceive, sometimes with the intent of revealing the hoax, I'd like to just kind of quote somebody who said, so Michael Parenti was sort of contesting this idea of strong relativism, because if people vie and fight and struggle over the definition of the situation or what's considered true, he said, well, we do know that truth exists because we know that liars exist, right? And that's kind of some of the impetus behind it. Yeah, I really like that quote, right? That's kind of how I approached my my task, which was to say, I don't know if I can prove that our counter movement is outright lying, like they're intentionally deceiving, because okay, it could be possible that they're just all operating by the same erroneous assumptions and bad data and things like that. But if you can sort of show a consistency in their behaviors, like Trump consistently lies, right? And that's kind of one of the ways that we know that he's lying is that he's just consistently saying things that just are not true. And it's to the point where it's like the guy has to know he's lying, or some people say he's a pathological liar, in which case maybe he doesn't know he's lying. And this gives us a problem. What if people don't know that they're lying? And so what I like to do is I separate out conventionalists. And these are people who sort of just buy into the conventional narratives. They're not necessarily lying or trying to spread myths, but they just believe what news media, what government, what their teachers have told them. And they'll argue over politics and religion and things like that. But generally they just buy into conventional narratives. I think what the quote unquote debunkers are doing is a little bit more devious, in that the people at Popular Mechanics seem to go out of their way to distort facts into, you know, what would you call it? Just to ignore facts. And that brings me around to where I started, this idea of ignoring information. You see, you can ignore information because you're just not aware of it. Most people are not aware of World Trade Center 7. It doesn't mean they're trying to ignore it. But when you bring that up...
That's a pretty good summary, yeah. I think. We need to move on. We got one more question and we're out of time. So let's go to Barbara.
Sure.
Who made it into the queue? How about that? Go ahead, Barbara.
Ken, it's Craig. I can't use the queue, so I'd like to be on there as well.
All right. Okay.
Sorry, I tend to ramble.
Okay, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Rich?
Yes.
Oh, good. Great. Yeah, it's Barb Vonnegut here. My first comment, I have two quick comments and then a question. The first comment is thank you so much for your work. I think it's a major advance for our movement. I think it's fascinating that you were able to legitimize this through the field of sociology. Just for everybody to know, another highly controversial field is, of course, parapsychology. I earned the first ever accredited graduate degree in the United States and the world in that field. And
oh, wow.
That was a master's degree. And the only way that my colleague and friend Jeffrey Mishlove could get a PhD, which was at UC Berkeley, he tried to get a PhD in the objective aspect of parapsychology, of the data in the field, et cetera, from experimentation. And that wouldn't fly. He couldn't get any professor to let him do it. So he had to go at it exactly the way you did, from a sociological perspective. And he got the first ever PhD kind of obliquely in the field of parapsychology, although not directly. Mm-hmm. So I find it fascinating that you were able to succeed in this way. So that was that comment. The other major comment I want to make is that people need to remember that the official authorized version of events, for instance, the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, all of the 9/11 Commission report, the official authorized versions of major world events are often themselves what we call limited hangouts in the intelligence world, because something has gone wrong. A perfect example, I was fascinated that you mentioned that the people on the other side say, oh, well, there are conspiracies. Look at Iran-Contra. But people need to remember that the official version of Iran-Contra itself is a limited hangout. And I am the author of the book October Surprise, the very first book October Surprise, which revealed the full, deep story of the Iran side of Iran-Contra as the hostage delay deal. So the official version of Iran-Contra was, in fact, to try to stop people investigating further into what really happened. So those are my comments, and my question is this. In your work, and I look forward to reading your dissertation, I hope that if it isn't already online, that you'll be able to give us the link so that we can all read it, and we'll go to chapter 4. My comment, or my question is, what do you address, and if not, hopefully you will be, what do you do about the fact, and we can prove this, both in 9/11 and also, for instance, the moon landing controversy debate, we can prove that officialdom itself intentionally produces fake so-called evidence of its official theory. And a perfect example of that is this recent film by Massimo Mazzucco called American Moon. There's no question whatsoever that the official video and the stills taken from the video of the alleged Apollo 11 and other later Apollo moon landings, that they're fake. They're from a studio. But that doesn't, of course, rule out that we actually did go to the moon. So so we do know that some of the videos, especially of the World Trade Center 2 plane impact, are doctored in some major way. But that doesn't rule out, of course, from other lines of evidence, that there was an actual plane that hit the building, although probably not the one that the official story claims. So my question to you is, what do you do? Do you already address, and if not, I hope you will, what do you do about officialdom itself intentionally using fake evidence for the official story? Thank you.
Faked evidence.
Yes.
I guess with September 11, was there any faked evidence that, like with the World Trade Center buildings?
Yes. In fact, Richard Gage might want to speak to that. He's working on, I happen to know from another call, from our 9/11 attorneys group that I'm on the board, and the European tap call. I happen to know that Richard is right now working on a major paper that addresses exactly that. But some of the videos of the World Trade Center 2, allegedly Flight 175, plane impact are doctored. They are not at least completely real. And they have been put out by officialdom. But of course that doesn't mean that a plane didn't hit the building, which is what people on the other side claim. Or debunkers within our movement who are probably infiltrators will say, oh, well, see, because some of those videos are faked and they only, of course, cherry-pick the ones that are for World Trade Center 2, they will then jump to the completely non-sequitur conclusion that, see, there was no plane. It was all holograms or whatever. So one of our major problems in the movement, and I believe I've talked to David Ray Griffin about this, our colleague, David Ray Griffin and I have had conversations, like over wine, you know, of the fact that the officialdom itself uses obviously and easily discoverable faked evidence to support the official claims.
Yeah. So, while you're talking, remember that. I think it was Philip Zelikow who wrote his dissertation on, I think it was called the care and repair of public myths or something like that, sort of how to propagandize, the mm-hmm. the public. And I guess, was it Plato called it the noble lie?
Right. And also how to maintain the myth as well.
Right. And then it was Cass Sunstein who wrote that book, Conspiracy Theories, Causes, and Cures, which David Ray Griffin wrote the really, really great book, Cognitive Infiltration. So we have reason to suspect that the authorized version is constructed by people who, as a sociologist, I would say we have the evidence to guide our suspicions that the people who constructed that authorized version are motivated to distort the events. And then I would say so for my sort of the central claim that I focus on would say, well, you know, when you compare the sort of NIST computer generated model to the video of World Trade Center 7 collapsing, the model doesn't look like the collapse of the building. And so You have Shyam Sundar saying that, for the first time we had normal office fires leading to progressive collapse. They won't give us the data to the model, hence Dr. Holsey's study. And then even the information that we do have about the model doesn't look like the videoed collapse. So, I would say I'm going to reference Michael Parenti one more time. And he said he's got a good book called Contrary Notions, which is a collection of his essays. And he said, reality is a problem for the ruling class because they have to constantly finesse the propaganda when reality doesn't match what they're saying. And the example he gave was the German population, kept noticing that the battles were getting closer and closer to Germany and then were across the German border. And so, they knew the government was lying. So I guess kind of first of all, we know that the people who constructed this story have it in their interest to construct and maintain and disrupt counter-narratives to the authorized version. We know that the government won't give us scientifically valid and, logical information about the collapse of this one building. I think over time when you start sort of adding these information points into a bigger picture of all the explanations. I think that gives us a good impetus to challenge those claims. Now, why they do it? Well, this is an empire that we're dealing with. An empire needs to engage in conquest, and they don't care whether they do it you know, with just cause or surreptitiously, I think.
Well, just one other thing.
Barbara, one more sentence. No. Barbara, you've already gone way over time. You've taken 10 minutes of the time, and we've already
I haven't taken the time. The answer took the time.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I really do have to cut you off because we're way over time on this. So thank you for the whole. It was a very
You tend to cut me off and not other people, by the way, Ken.
Oh, yeah. Well, other people didn't take 10 minutes, Barbara. I'm sorry.
I didn't take the 10 minutes. The answer
didn't.
Yes, you did. No, I didn't.
Okay, so now let's thank Rich for his time with sharing his time with us, giving us some really interesting things to consider in the future. I hope that you will, Richard, send us the link to your dissertation so that people can review it at their leisure, and especially the chapter 4 that you've highlighted, and get a take
sure.
on it directly.
It's available online.
Oh, yeah, but we need a link. So if you would send a link to Craig, then we'll put
absolutely.
It in the minutes and the others can... you already did?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. All right. So again, thank you. And let's go out of Q&A mode. And did anyone not have an opportunity to get into Q&A that was trying to? We have to ask that question. Good. Because
well, I never did. I had a question
Craig,
coming
Craig,
at the
yes,
end.
Yes, Craig, you did, yes. And we have to give you an opportunity. So go ahead.
I mean, I mean, if we're, you know, into trouble area with time, I don't mind. But I think our second guest is not here. Am I wrong about
that? No, she's here.
Oh, okay. Didn't realize that. Okay.
Well, then I'll make it onto somebody else's number. Okay.
Oh, I see. Okay, that. Okay.
Craig,
can
you just make it real quick?
I will. I just wanted to throw a comment, something out for you to comment on. One thing I've noticed a lot in discourse on Facebook and other, you know, social media platforms, is that you'll have people who are inside the 9/11 truth movement who will, when they talk about other potential conspiracies like the moon landings, will talk about those much in the same way that the average person would talk about them or about 9/11 truth. Like they'll make fun of them as being kooky conspiracies and you're crazy and you're discrediting, you know, 9/11 truth. And I just wondered if you would want to just give a quick comment about that phenomenon of people that kind of use the same tactics really that are used against us routinely, and they don't seem to see that there's a contradiction in that.
Yeah, so it's possible that this is part of the broader anti-conspiracist discourse that has been sown into society at least since the 1960s, if not even before that, in that CIA dispatch. And so there's a good article by a guy named Goshorn that's online, he talks about this anti-conspiracy discourse, anti-conspiracist. So there's been a long agenda over decades to sort of create the logic of how to treat what are generally called conspiracy theories. And so I don't find it remarkable that people who kind of know that 9/11, let's just say 9/11 was an inside job, that they out of hand dismiss other conspiracy theories. So for example, I really kind of out of hand dismiss the flat Earth hypothesis. I can see how some of the logics of anti-conspiracist discourse operate in that fashion. Just as an example, but yeah, I mean, there's lots of people out there who hold a variety of different beliefs. For example, there are you know, hard-nosed quantitative scientists who are deeply religious, right? They're and things of that nature, right? So human beings are just complex in and of themselves, have many many thoughts and ideas. Just because you believe in, you know, one set of ideas doesn't mean you have to believe in another. And then when we talk about this idea of discourse, I kind of spell this out in the second chapter of my dissertation, but there are logics that operate in which they help people explain the way the world works. So that's why I say I don't find it surprising that, you know, for example, there are, you know, people who believe in one conspiracy, but they really don't believe in another, and they're sort of dismissive and that kind of stuff. I would just say it's kind of expected.
Okay.
Thank you again, Richard.
We deeply appreciative of the discourse tonight and the edification. So, with no further ado, then let us move on to our second speaker tonight. And Cheryl will introduce the illustrious Bonnie Fodler. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, so I'm glad Bonnie has joined us tonight. And Bonnie has been producing Guns and Butter for 17 years on KPFA. And it also is carried by WBAI in New York City and many Pacifica affiliates. The show was conceived as an economics show, but the very first broadcast on October 12, 2001, with Michael Ruper was on the show was on the massive put options on 9/11. So from the beginning, Guns and Butter has been focused on 9/11 also. And so Bonnie's here tonight to share with us her recent experience with having had her show abruptly kicked off of KPFA. So and maybe a little bit of censorship she'll talk about. So Bonnie, welcome, and it's all yours.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. It's a little difficult for me to know even where to start. But like you pointed out, the show was conceived as an economic show at KPFA. It's all pre-produced, edited, and mixed, and available to all of the Pacifica affiliates. And, of course, I've been producing it for 17 years. The show has been extremely popular with the listeners.
Did we lose Bonnie?
Is anybody there?
Yeah, it sounds like we've lost Bonnie Faulkner.
Bob Petrakis is here.
Oh, hi. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, how are you?
Good.
So, Ken, I was just wondering, we didn't go into presentation mode. Do we not do that anymore for technical reasons? Or?
Well, it depends. If there's significant background noise, we always do. But otherwise, ask people. So far, people have been pretty cooperative tonight about meeting themselves, so it hasn't been an issue.
Yeah, well, it just seemed like we were getting some noise
I'm
in the last couple
that
minutes.
We've lost a number of people here, not just Bonnie Faulkner. We're down to about 9 people on the call.
Ken, I'm going to just interrupt you. I think Bonnie's coming in under Tim Michael's name, and I think she was. Bonnie, are you there?
Oh,
yes. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I think she was muted.
Ken.
Okay.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you, Bonnie.
Oh, my God, this is so
weird. But
we
couldn't for a few minutes there.
Oh, because I heard all of this noise. Like, oh, anyway. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we heard that, too.
Yeah. Should I start? You can hear me.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, please begin. Yeah. Sorry for that. I don't know what that was.
You probably have to start over again, Bonnie. I don't think we heard much of what you had to say.
All right. Well, I just started by saying that it's a little difficult to know where to start after 17 mm-hmm. years of programming. But like Cheryl pointed out, the show was conceived of as an economic show, and it immediately on the first broadcast became a 9/11 show, much about 9/11. So the show on KPFA was extremely popular with the listeners, who donated multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations to that station. I mean, I remember a time in an hour and a half, I raised $22,000 for them, $16,000 in 10 minutes. They liked the money, okay? So they take the listeners' money, but they don't care about the listeners or what they want to hear, obviously. because the station never promoted the show. Guns and Butter was always at cross purposes with the politics of the station, which is basically Democratic Party, I would say. It's identity politics, political correctness. You know the drill. So that's what it is. But I never had any problem with any of the 9/11 programming, and I did a massive amount of it, many, many hours with David Ray Griffin. Richard Gage found out about 9/11 from my show and started coming to our events. I've pretty much interviewed most all of the major 9/11 researchers, maybe not all of them, but a whole lot of them. So the show has been very important in that vein, and also with regard to geopolitics, with regard to the financial crisis. I've done a lot of economic programming, etc. Anyway, the first, and I never had any problem. They never touched the show. About 3 years ago, the first ripple of censorship happened, and that was in, and I'm in California, obviously, and the California legislature was about to pass a very draconian vaccination bill that would require an extreme amount of vaccinations for people to go to school, for kids. And I was we were going into fund drive, so I was going to have Gary Null on with some of his films on vaccines. And they intercepted that, and they did not allow that to be broadcast. So that was the first time that censorship ever raised its ugly head. Then there was a little bit more kerfuffle about my interviews with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on the same subject. Nothing was said. In the meantime, once in a while, an irate listener would send an email into the management, and they would gleefully forward it on to me. But there were very, very few of those such incidents. What happened finally, I guess the final blow, I guess maybe a lot of you have watched the Deep Truth Conference on No Lies Radio. Maybe some of you have. The very last panel was on Zionism, and I broadcast the first three speakers, which were Kevin Barrett, Philip Giraldi, and Gilad Atzmon. And that went over okay, I guess. I didn't get any feedback on that except for positive stuff. But then the fourth speaker was Alan Zabrowski, and I on the history of the U.S. support for Israel. And after that broadcast, I guess they felt that they had me. That's what they used. That was one of the things that they used to cancel the show. Now, what you have to understand about the station, KPFA, is that they now have a kind of a corporate type in the GM slot. He's been there for around 3 years. I don't even know the guy. He's an African-American professional. He goes by an assumed name that's not even his real name. And I understand that he came to KPFA from a children's museum in Oakland, which had, when he was there, canceled the Middle East Children's Alliance art show of Palestinian children. So there's this whole a Zionist thing. And I think, in my opinion, that's what did it. What is a very... Oh, anyway, well, I'll let's see what happened. He sent me a couple of irate emails after my last show, and that was with Alan Zabrowski, and that was on the Zionism thing. Then we went into fund drive, and I was about ready to fund drive, and then they sent me an email telling me that I had been preempted for the fund drive, which had never happened before. And then when that was over with, when I was going to broadcast on my regular day, I got the following email from the station. Now, maybe many of you know this. I've written a whole thing up on my website, and I can send you a link. But this is what I got. Bonnie, this is quote, Bonnie, KPFA will cease broadcasting Guns and Butter effective immediately. We've received an avalanche of negative calls and emails from listeners about your uncritically airing of views by a Holocaust denier, climate denial, and casting the Parkland mass shooting survivors as crisis actors. As steward of our airwaves, we can't defend this content to our listeners. Sincerely, and he signs his name, and then he's got this guy who was a volunteer there that he just stuck in the program director slot. Parenthetically, under this Quincy McCoy, this general manager, he's run the chief, he's run out long-term employees from the station. Our chief engineer, who'd been there forever, he ran him out. The program director quit, and also the database manager quit. And these are people that had been around for 20 years. So, and with the chief engineer longer. So there's something going on at the station. And, of course, as you all know, there's something going on generally with censorship. This happened on August 8th. Now, I believe it was also in August when they went after Alex Jones, which obviously it doesn't really have anything to do with my show, but that this would happen is a real red flag about what's going on in this country. I never had any problem before. Now, I also want to say that the Pacifica Radio Network is listener-sponsored and non-commercial, and they have this the democratic governance structure, and it's very unwieldy. Each station has a local station board of 25 members, and then they elect people to the national board. And the people on the boards are so stupid, most of them. It's unbelievable. They are such conformists, book burners. I just finally went in and listened to the audio of the last station board, and these people don't even know how to listen to a show and understand what is being said. Several of them now publicly and even to the press are claiming that Alan Zabrowski, he was the one that they're calling the Holocaust denier, they are claiming that on my show he was calling for a U.S. preemptive attack on Iran, and that I was supporting that. Now, these people are out of their minds. I mean, they're bad. Wow. They're idiots. They repeat this. They repeat it to this press. I mean, there's no words. I mean, how do you come up? And these are board members. So now I just got an email from someone who used to be high up in Pacifica governance. He was actually secretary of the national board, and they've come out publicly. Hold on, where do I find this? They've come out publicly with a statement. Oh, also, I wrote up this big explanation of what happened and sent it out to my email list, and when the local station board was actually having what they call a town hall meeting, coincidentally, right after my show got banned, and 65 people showed up in person in Berkeley to speak at the public comments in support of the show, I was there. I've just now learned that the audio recording of that has been erased. The station has removed, this is KPFA in Berkeley, they have removed 17 years of archives of Guns and Butter, wiped it off. It's not accessible, okay? Now, this is what I've now reading that was stated at, so then the GM shows up. He didn't show up at when I was there, but he came the next month, and he wanted to talk to them about the banning of Guns and Butter, insisted that they go into executive session, which is secret. Nobody can hear it. I had sent an email into the board saying that I waived any rights I had to privacy and to make it public. They came out with the bogus claim that it was a personnel matter, as if I'm an employee. I'm not an employee. They've never given me a dime. So they go into this secret session, and he tells all these lies about me and the show. He claims, I understand, some of it's leaked out. I understand that he claimed that I had threatened the station that if they took my show off, I'd call out the dogs. These are all lies. I've never threatened the station. That is absolutely crazy. The people on this stupid board are saying that I had been, quote, warned. Well, warned of what? I don't know what they're talking about. It's just unbelievable the level of corruption and immorality and lies. What else can I say? I wanted to read you this. Okay, this is they made this public statement recently. Quote, the KPFA LSB, that's the local station board, has investigated the removal of Guns and Butter from the Pacifica KPFA airwaves, and the majority of the local station board agreed that journalistic standards were not followed and that progressive discipline processes were followed and that majority support for the GM passed 11 yes, 3 no, 1 abstention. See, now, when they talk about progressive discipline processes, they're trying to cover themselves because there was no due process. I've only talked to the GM once in my life, and it was years ago. They just arbitrarily took the show off, and they're just making up all of these excuses and rationale for having done so, and claiming that certain things happened that didn't happen, and the low level of board members is truly shocking. Now, I don't want to take up too much time, but one thing I do want to say is that when I joined KPFA in 2001, it was an extremely lively station. There was a lot going on. It was full of energy. Community members were in there. Everybody was involved. If you went in there today, it's like a morgue. There is no energy, and nothing is happening. And it's just very creepy. The politics of the station are horrible. The guy on the morning show at Drive Time is quoted as having called for the indictment of Julian Assange. This is how bad it is. Wow. Now, it's very shocking. Now, I could go on and on, but I won't. I don't want to take up too much time. In conclusion, I will say that I'm still producing the show, but if I can't do what I want to do or pursue the truth as I see it, I'm not going to produce the show. I have no interest in producing a show about a lot of BS. Now, today, I've been fundraising for weeks on WBAI in New York. They're always fundraising. But the show this morning was with William Engdahl, and he took down this whole global warming thing. He went into the whole history of it. He's written a whole book on it. And I don't care. If I get any flack about it, too bad. I won't produce this show. And I also want to say that this censorship thing, now, I had pulled up an article I wanted to talk about, and I lost it because I pushed the wrong button on my computer. It was some politician in Europe, and he was quoted as saying, this is only the beginning when they're talking about censorship. And what they are using as an excuse is this Russiagate baloney about how we have to protect the Internet from people that are messing around with the elections and putting out fake news. And he was quoted as saying, this is only the beginning. And I can feel that. For them to go after my show, it's not like I'm on some major network. There is a crackdown going on in this country, and I think it's very, very serious. So anyway, thank you for listening. And on my website, gunsandbutter.org, if you go into the blog, I can send you a link if you want. I can show you my response to what happened, and there's also 100 comments from the listeners. Oh, by the way, hundreds of people have written letters to the national board, to the GM, to the local station board. It makes no difference whatsoever. They don't care about the listeners. They just have a certain politics that they're going to follow. There was something else I wanted to say about that. Anyway, there's 100 comments on this blog site. You could read them if you're interested. So,
Bonnie, maybe,
so that's
maybe
it.
You could
so
tell people maybe you could
me.
Tell people how they could how they can write to board or how they would go about that if they want to make a protest.
Well, that's in the blog, and
okay.
I can send you a link because it
okay.
has all of the email addresses
mm-hmm.
of the national board,
okay.
The interim executive director, the GM. It's
yep.
all there. I laid it all
yep.
out.
Okay.
So
if you would send a copy of that to Craig, I'm sure we can put that explicitly in the minutes. I doubt that anyone's going to object to
if,
that.
If you want to. If you
yes,
go to gunsandbutter.org and you go up to the top menu, you can click on blog mm-hmm. and scroll down, and it says Guns and Butter banned and removed from KPFA radio.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all there.
Yeah, I can find that, Ken, and put
okay.
it in.
Okay. Thank you, Craig. That'll
yeah.
save the time. Okay.
I'd like to get in the queue, too. It's just while you're
sure. okay.
formulating that part.
We'll put you up right after we get started. Is that it, Bonnie? Are you?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I could go on and on, but what's the
oh,
point,
yeah.
you know?
Well, I'm sure that others would like to, interact with you on this question because it's been certainly plaguing all of us. So let's go into Q&A mode here. And before we get there, I'd like to say two things, Bonnie. Well, actually, only one now because we've cleared up how to go about protesting. But I don't know if you're aware of the fact that I was once on the national board myself of Pacifica. I was run off for reasons not dissimilar from the ones that are affecting you at the moment. So I have to say that all of this, as shocking as it all is, doesn't come as much of a surprise. The KPFT local station board was equally controlled by the Democratic Party. I believe all of Pacifica in general is more or less under the aegis of the, let's call them the liberal democratics milieu. So I think a lot of the source of the problem stems from that, and the whole Russiagate thing, of course, is spawned by exactly that same ilk. So it's not, all of this seems to make a perfect kind of sense within that paradigm, as tragic as it all is, and I'm deeply sorry that this has happened because it's a calamity for the airwaves. So let's move on to our first question. Let's see who's in the queue. Oh, Craig. Craig, you asked to put a piece, or you go ahead first. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I don't know if this is a question or not. It's more just a comment and a bit of news about something very similar that I just found out happened to me just actually today. I got an email from WordPress telling me that they had taken my website, Truth and Shadows, down. So, and this is something that was not a total shock because I've seen this happening to other WordPress websites. It happened to AmericanEveryman.com, which used to be Willie Loman, which was a blog that talked about 9/11 among other subjects. Ken Doc's website was taken down, and I know James Tracy had his website taken down, although I don't know that it was by WordPress. But anyway, so I wasn't totally shocked by this, but I guess I can certainly relate. Although you've been doing what you do for a lot longer than I have, but my blog's been up 8 years, and it has, 220 articles on it, something like that, and that's all, just been wiped out, although I apparently have a small window to export the data, so that doesn't mean necessarily that all the all the text is gone, but it certainly puts me back to square one in terms of a website. I mean, my website in terms of traffic, I believe, was about, I think, next to Architects and Engineers, I think was probably had the most traffic of any site that focuses on 9/11. And so anyway, I just sort of mentioned that, and you can comment on it if you want. I mean, it seems to be what you've experienced seems to be happening in a lot of different areas, with blogs, with YouTube channels, it just seems to be an internet-wide purge going on. Anyway, that's it for me.
Well, Craig, I'm so sorry to hear that. that is really going to be a big hurdle to overcome. Okay, let's see, Barbara, you next.
Well, yeah, I go, but doesn't Bonnie have a response to that first off, or not? What Craig said.
You know what? I think Bonnie might be muted. Let's double check this, but I think it's possible she's muted. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, Bonnie, I'm sorry. You've been muted. Do you want to respond to anything that's been
said
before?
Thank you.
Before,
I was wondering what was happening there. Yeah. Well, I just want to say I'm very happy to meet you, Craig, and I think very highly of your Truth and Shadows. And absolutely.
Thank you.
I mean, I just WordPress is taking stuff down. Google is changing algorithms. You name it. I mean, we all know what's going on. It's very, very serious. If they can get away with shutting everybody down, I don't know. But anyway, thank you. And I want to agree that, yes, Pacifica is pretty much Democratic Party politics. That's absolutely right.
Thanks.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Hi, Bonnie. Good to hear your voice. We're going to be together in Dallas. For everybody who doesn't already know, they're from the 16th to the 18th in Dallas are the two big JFK conferences for anybody who wants to go. And I can send Craig the links to that. Bonnie will be covering it. She's got a media pass, and we'll be rooming together there with Jane Clark, who was the president of, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. So, you know, anybody who wants to go to the JFK conference, Bonnie and I and Jane Clark will definitely be there. My comment about
happened. Did you say December?
What?
December or September? Did you say December or November?
November.
November 16th to 18th.
Yes, that's correct. I'll send the links to the two conferences. One's called JFK Lancer, and the other one is put on by Lee Harvey Oswald's former mistress, Judith Baker. So there are two simultaneous, unfortunately, conferences, and you almost have to this year for the first time choose between them because they're miles apart. They used to be just a few blocks apart in different hotels. But anyway, you could choose to go to one day and one the other or something like that, but that would be a double registration fee. But they're great conferences. I actually prefer the Judith Baker one from last year. Bonnie and I went last year with Jane Clark. And I consider that one the better conference. But it all depends upon you. You can see who the speakers are. I'll send you the links to the two conferences. But I have a couple of comments and then a question for Bonnie about what happened. Just to clarify for people, Kat McGuire this June put on the Deep Truth online 3-day conference. And every single one, I was a speaker at that as well, and on the 9/11 panel, and every single one of those was controversial, you can imagine. Every single one of the topics, every one. Either the next to the last panel, I think the last panel, was the one with Alan Sabrowski. And the pretext for removing Bonnie included a comment that she had put on a so-called Holocaust denier. There is only one possibility for what they were referring to, and that would have been the Alan Sabrowski talk. And what's weird is that within that presentation, which went on for at least about an hour, he only mentioned in passing something to the effect that every single topic people should have a right to comment on, and that he's looked into the Holocaust, and there are legitimate questions about the details of the official story. This is anything but a denial. It's just saying that there should be open inquiry about everything. And so they really leaned over backwards to pull out a passing comment in one of like 20 controversial programs in order to justify doing this to Bonnie. And the other comment that I wanted to make to have Bonnie's comment on is in Alan Sabrowski's, if you haven't already seen or watched all of those Deep Truth conference presentations. You really should. But go first to the one of Ellen Sabrowski, and it's particularly relevant to this call because what's most important in my mind in his presentation, this is this past June 2018, is that he says after a discussion, there's much more discussion in his presentation on 9/11, and at the end of his discussion on 9/11, he states explicitly, he said, you know, I made a huge mistake all these years. I have been focusing on the World Trade Center and World Trade Center 7, and that was a mistake. I should have focused on the Pentagon. So I just want everybody to know that, and I think everybody on this call should watch his presentation, if only to see how he leads up to that statement. It's really moving. So Bonnie, I'd just like you to comment on the fact that they pulled out this passing comment about and then pulled it all out of perspective. It was anything but saying Sabrowski never said anything close to being a Holocaust denier, not even close.
Well, he cited an International Red Cross report from 1947 that said 300,000 people had died in these camps. And he referenced a couple of Army videos of the of Dachau camp. And he said one of them was real and one of them was fake. But as you pointed out, Barbara, it's right in the middle of his talk, and it's not the focus of it.
No.
Now, what I didn't understand was that they must have been gunning for my show. Now, they mentioned climate denial, which is a nonsensical term, but I had done programming with Ben Davidson and Electric Universe on the sun and its effects on the climate and the weakening Earth's magnetosphere and all like that. Well, I guess that's you just can't even talk about scientific issues unless you're carrying their a political thing about global warming. And then they made a reference, and these are just excuses. I mean, I don't really know why. The other thing was this business about crisis actors. Now, they're claiming... See, I did a show with Jim Fetzer. We were both watching this really outrageous March for Our Lives, if you guys can remember that, after the Parkland, Florida school shooting. It was just amazing. And Jim and I did a show on that, and he never referred to the students as crisis actors. He did talk about that David Hogg guy, though. So I just think, and I've done in his historically, I've done shows on false flag. So and none of this is their politics. What's interesting to me is that this was fine and dandy for a million for you know 16 years, and all of a sudden it's no longer acceptable. So the timing of this is what's unnerving.
Well, you know, Bonnie, I'd just like people to know that August 8th, this is the first I learned that you were banned on officially on August 8th. That happens to be, it's almost certainly a coincidence, but who knows? August 8th is the day that Robert David Steele was told that the memos that Richard Gage and myself and David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott and about 24 total 9/11 truth memos were delivered to the West Wing for Trump the very same day.
Well, yeah, so the other thing about Pacifica is they have these nutty activists that are like on the boards and they're activists, but they're book burners is what they are. It's really frightening. I never, somebody told me about a new term, the authoritarian left. Well, I don't consider Pacifica left. It's Democratic Party, which has always been, already been pointed out. But I don't know. For them to go after my show, Now, I'm okay on WBAI. The GM there is a Haitian guy, Berthold, and he's a lot cooler. So we'll see. But I can tell from emails that I've received that there was a push within the Pacifica network to get the affiliates to drop my show. And I think some of them did, but a lot of them didn't. So there is a push, a censorship push. And there's no question about it.
Bonnie, let people know that your past programs, the audio files, are still available on your website. I don't think you mentioned that.
Yeah, they're on SoundCloud. I mean, at least the last few years. I haven't put up 17 years worth. I could, I suppose. But, if you go to gunsandbutter.org, they're all there. They're on SoundCloud, the most recent shows.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Barb.
Okay, let's see. Is anybody else in the queue here? Yeah, Jonathan Mark wants to ask a question or make a comment. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Hi, this is Jonathan Mark. I publish flybynews.com. I've been, dealing with the Cassini flyby since 1999 and trying to stop the weaponization of space. And after 9/11, I had to do a lot of research on that. But I try to stick with some sort of looking forward to what we can do in Unity ahead of schedule, because we always seem to be reacting to, the terror that's on a big increase. So when it was the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we tried, but it kind of like, I think, blown from within as well as from without, in a way of not unifying the world in what you can do. Maybe by the 20th anniversary that will happen. But next year is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo lunar missions, and the more I look into it, because there wasn't internet at the time of it, and we were very susceptible, introduced to TV and as children and all the movies and the effects. But now that we have the experts reviewing it in such a way, and because of the time span of not leaving low Earth orbit since 1972 and not telling us what's happening with the Orion mission when they measured the radiation fields, I think that the 2019 50th anniversary can give us an opportunity to awaken people, because that will... even though that people don't care about it or they'll ridicule you, it's a tough business. But in actuality, it shows you that the JFK assassination really happened. And ever since then, there's been some sort of shadow government controlling every president more than ever. And the foreign policy has been very obvious. So the lunar thing, as crazy as it sounds, being 50th anniversary, could have a reverse impact. I know they just put out a Hollywood movie with Neil Armstrong, and we're up against a lot, but I encourage you to watch the full 3.5-hour Massimo Mazzucco's film, American Moon, and keep considering that. And an article I wrote called Litmus Tests for Truth and Transformation, just in case they came out and they had to admit to the lunar issue. I was trying to project what we can do with that. But it's a pleasure to follow you all these years, and I'm so grateful you're here, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. And it's interesting, on that Parkland School shooting show that I did with Jim Fetzer, he actually talked about the moonshot and took it apart. In 1969, I was in college typing my term papers on a typewriter. So it does seem quite bizarre. But anyway, thank you, Jonathan. Oh, you know what? I did an interview with the late David McGowan on the moonshot, because he took that apart. But the guy that mixes my show was so upset about it, I didn't air it, and I think I've lost the audio. I can't believe it, because Apple gave me the wrong hard drive back. And the show is gone. I can't find it. So, but it would be good to do something on the moonshot. I'd like that.
Well, I'll send you an email. I went to your website, and I'll send you an email. And I interviewed Massimo too, and that's a half-hour program that's online. And it's good to connect on it because we have time now and we have this great tool. So I think we're doing another teleconference on November 11th with Massimo Mazzucco. He's from Italy, and
yeah.
He just did a tremendous job.
Wonderful. Thank you. If you send me the link, I'll watch that.
Thank you. Okay. Have a good night. Ken?
Did anyone try to get into the Q&A and wasn't able to? Okay, well then, in closing, I want to say this to you, Bonnie. As a former national board member, I want you to know that your program was one of my main motivations for being involved in Pacifica. I was instrumental in getting it broadcast on KPFT shortly after we took back the station. And I consider this the deepest of possible tragedies. And although I hope you resume broadcasting very soon on KPFA, whether that happens or not, I just want to personally thank you for what you've done to fulfill the Pacifica mission like no other show really has, okay?
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Okay, so we're ready for our next. Thank you again, Bonnie, for taking the time. Let's move on to our next agenda item. That would be election fraud. And we have with us Richard Fitrakis, and to introduce him, I think Craig, right?
No, it's me.
I'm sorry.
No. Okay?
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
Okay. Okay, so, and thank you, Bonnie. Bonnie just talked about the Russian hacking of our elections nonsense that is being used to justify the censorship that we're experiencing now. And that ties right into our next speaker, Robert Fitrakis, who is going to talk to us about what's really going on in our elections. And just as a quick bio and background for Robert, he's an American lawyer, political author and writer, political candidate, and professor of political science in the Social and Behavioral Sciences Department at Columbus State Community College. He's been the editor of the Columbus Free Press since 1993 and wrote extensively about the U.S. presidential election, 2004, and related 2004 U.S. election voting controversies. His most recent book, The Strip and Flip Disaster of America's Stolen Elections, updated Trump edition of Strip and Flip section of selection of 2016, is a collaboration with Harvey Wasserman. So, Robert, thank you very much for being willing to join us tonight. And it's all yours.
Yeah, let me, I know you've been on a while, so I'll hit some of the highlights here. I did a long paper for the American Political Science Association, of course not well received because they like the numbers. They don't want to hear they may not be accurate. But it's, are U.S. elections legitimate, the history of electronic voting? And again, my basic thesis is that which used to be done covertly in the third world, what was known as, quote, benign operations, which came out during the Church Committee reports, Pike report. That is, you know, we rigged elections. They weren't bloody coups. You just went in and manipulated elections. That's pretty much what has been done in the United States because we've set the election system up in a fairly absurd way. That is, we allow private partisan corporations to secretly program the computer voting machines, the county and precinct tabulators, and the firmware on the machines. So it doesn't meet any basic standard of transparency. Is that essentially these private companies. And in Ohio, I stumbled on this after the 2004 election. It's primarily the Right to Life movement that was controlling everything in Ohio from the voting rolls, which really are big data. I mean, one way to look at this is all just massively, you know, big data. whether it's the voting rolls done by Triad and the Rapp family, the leading Right to Life family in Ohio, or Michael Connell, who died tragically after setting up a system, which we proved in court. We had a six-year case called King Lincoln Brunsville versus J. Kenneth Blackwell, where we actually found the architectural map showing there was a back door in the Ohio system, and the votes had actually been counted in the old Pioneer Bank building in Chattanooga, Tennessee, by a former born-again evangelical minister named Jeff Averbeck for a company called Smart Tech. And by the way, Smart Tech, as Connell, who had New Media, which was a Republican company, and he also had GovTech, which was run by his wife, who didn't know she owned the company. So they did the government work as well as doing all the Republican websites, including the president's, George GWB 43, as well as the Swift Voters for Truth. So you're in this absurd situation where none of this would be acceptable by the U.S. State Department or USAID if it was being done in a foreign country. In the 2016 election, you had 13 states where the exit polls would have been red flags had they not been states but had been nations or nation states, because there were three or more deviations outside the norms of allowable behavior. And part of what's going on as well is, of course, the use of the software, the basic software used all over America, GEMS, General Election Management System. Some of you may know counts in fractions. It was adopted from corporate software to count stocks, which are counted at different levels and in fractions in some cases. But people tend not to ask the basic questions. You know, why for example, would private companies be allowed to secretly program the machines? Why aren't these being done by government entities? Why isn't it being done by open source? Why isn't there a ballot that can be recounted in every machine? I was Jill Stein's attorney, recount attorney for her election, but when we got into Pennsylvania, 87% of the votes couldn't be recounted because there was no paper in the machine. So, again, I worked with the International Observers following the first-ever election in El Salvador. I co-wrote that report and was the editor of the report and delivered it to the UN. And one of the things in the election was the process. And in that, the only thing the guerrillas could agree on, the FMLN with the right wing, the Mano Blanco, the death squad, was they wanted a box that was transparent, see-through. They went so they could see that no one had stuffed it ahead of time. And they wanted the ballots counted before the world, before the cameras, before the UN, before the election observers. Now, if I went into that situation, I was told, well, you know, the Arena Party, the fascist party on the right, has hired its best friends. And they're going to come in with a secret code. And no one can see the code. And they're going to count the votes without any paper trail. And they're going to come out and tell us how it worked out. You know, I've seen this before. My dad was a Teamster Union steward in Detroit. So, you know, I'm used to, you know, when they go in the back room and count the votes and nobody gets to see them. But this is the system that has been set up in the United States. Again, it's a totally illegitimate system. I mean, you should be using open source. In fact, one of the oddest things is former CIA director James Woolsey co-authored an article in the New York Times essentially saying that, you know, prodded, of course, by the Russians, who aren't the problem here. You know, they were engaged in small scale. They don't have the keys to the kingdom, as ES and S does, and Dominion, and hard inner civic, whose votes are flipping in Texas as we speak, and has been documented in the Houston Chronicle, the Independent, and admitted to by election officials. Some of you may have seen this. When you vote straight party ticket in Texas, it picks up Ted Cruz as a Democrat. So, again, in 2004 in Mahoning County, famous for mob connections, they admitted 31 of their machines were incorrectly calibrated. They used terms. There's another term for calibration. It means it's flipping the vote. You're voting for candidate A, it's giving the vote to candidate B. Also, many of these machines, ES and S machines, have cellular connections. So you can dial in to fix them during the election and, of course, to fix the election. Seidel, which was an overseas company, also from Barcelona, had direct input for military and overseas voters and a very close relationship with Booz Allen Hamilton, you know, who's famous for working with the CIA. So a lot of these companies, if you go back, you'll see military intelligence, you'll see all sorts of connections to the military intelligence industrial complex and mobsters and just corrupt people. That's my basic summary. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, Robert, that was a very well encapsulated overview. But I'm sure that there are probably a few folks that would like to further a few points. So let us move to Q&A, and we'll see if that's true. Star 6, if you'd like to be in the queue to make a comment or ask a question of our speaker regarding fixing and fixed elections. Okay. John O'Malley, you're first. Go ahead. Before you go, John, let me unmute our speaker so that he can respond to you if he so wishes. Let's see, there we go. Okay, go ahead.
This is John O'Malley. In Maryland, where I live, the elections are extremely corrupt, and we've seen clear evidence of this. And one thing that was interesting, in the 2016 election in Maryland Congressional District 7, when they were caught red-handed stealing the election, the guy that they stole the election from pursued legal action. And the one thing we learned from the legal action is that when a judge writes a decision where the only rational explanation of that decision is that this is just another one of those corrupt Maryland judges, then you have to assume that this is just another one of those corrupt Maryland judges. So the point of that is the corruption extends into the judiciary, at least in Maryland. Have you seen that in other states?
Well, interesting question. What we saw in Ohio was prior to the 2004 election, which came down to Ohio and where they essentially outsourced the vote to Smart Tech in Chattanooga, Tennessee, it was preceded by 4 years of essentially the illegal takeover of the elected courts in the state. And I mean illegal. My law partner at the time, Cliff Arnebeck, sued at the Ohio Election Commission, and I worked with him on the complaint, and we actually won. But they had changed the law where essentially money laundering into the judicial elections, it was a $1,000 fine. I mean, that was it, and you couldn't recover any lawyer's fees as a lawyer. So they systematically took over the Supreme Court in Ohio. It had been 4-3 with one of the Republicans, a swing vote, a fairly liberal guy. But in 2000, they moved money in 2002, and they swung the court so it was 6-1. And and what we realized when we came to sue in a very well-known case called Moss v. Bush, we sued to overturn the 2004 election. The people that heard it in Ohio was this brand-new, incredibly conservative Supreme Court. And they'd also moved new people into the appeals level. So there was it was a systematic thing. We found the pattern all over the country, is that they had taken over key positions. And it was always a bit of a crapshoot at the federal level. Sometimes you'd get a good judge, and sometimes you wouldn't. In fact, in 2012, we had a 37-year NSA veteran who's gone libertarian, computer expert, Donahoe, who the court wouldn't recognize as an expert when he said that the patches that were being used, these custom patches, weren't needed, and the only reason you'd be putting them on in Ohio was to steal votes. The judge said that he was not a computer expert. On the other hand, the other side with a guy with a 2-year degree and no real credentials, they accepted his notion that the company would never, ever steal votes, and it was a trust and honor system. But, yeah, they took over the judiciary, and it was planned. I think they needed to, because first you're stripping the voter rolls. You're targeting and stripping. And in Cleveland, between 2000 and 2004, they purged 24.96% of every single voter in the city that was voting 81%
wow.
Democrat. It was absolutely systematic, targeted, and to some extent brilliant if you're into heavy corruption and election rigging.
Okay, thanks. Cheryl, you're next.
Yeah, hi, this is Cheryl. I really have a couple of comments. I first heard about Robert Petrakis and his election research on No Lies Radio did a panel discussion with Mark Kristen Miller, and I think it was John Simon and Robert.
Yeah.
And
Cheryl?
You just
broke off. Repeat your point.
Okay, so that's where I got the idea to invite him onto the program tonight. And I also just wanted to say, I just got today in my local newspaper, there was an article about these election these vendors for these, election machines. And it's called Security-Challenged Firms Are Election Gatekeepers. And, of course, they say in there the reason they need security is to catch the Russians again. But but anyway, they are addressing it and saying how these people have no oversight. So I was kind of happy to at least see something about it in the paper. And that's it. Thank you, Robert, for being on.
Glad to do it. One of the things, because of Russia, there's a little more sensitivity. But they've known about this since 1964 when they first began to use the optical scan voting machines, the Norton Coleman, and they used mainframes. In fact, there's a very famous work, March 1975, Roy G. Saltman of the National Bureau of Standards writes a paper, government manual, Effective Use of Computing Technology in Vote Counting Reports. And he says, quote, increasingly computerization of election-related functions may result in the loss of effective control over these functions by responsible authorities, and that this loss of control may increase the possibility of vote fraud. That was written in March of 1975. And what they've allowed is a handful of people, many of them working closely, like the Savage Brothers, with the CIA. Some of them, admittedly, like Michael Connell, who died mysteriously in a plane crash after we deposed him at the day before the election in 2012 and got him to name names in terms of his apparatus. But these guys have worked in the Third World and think nothing of stealing election in the name of, you know, American democracy and righting the world's wrongs. So, again, I mean, they don't even hide it well. And the mainstream media is just getting to it. They're leaving out a lot of the, you know, obvious juicy stuff, but the New York Times actually broke down and, you know, wrote stuff, you know, that we were working on 14 years ago, but they won't go into the detail. But I'm glad they're finally going after these gatekeepers. Really, one of the men who really pointed this out to me, Ethan Gibbs, who one week after I wrote about him on MotherJones.com and a full-page article in my newspaper, the Columbus Free Press, he died tragically being hit by an 18-wheeler. But he was the guy that pointed out the connections to me between the Urasevich brothers, the two brothers that worked for, one for Diebold, one for ES&S, that really pioneered all of this secret software for the two major companies. But, you know, he pointed out their ties, that they had worked with the CIA and in the Third World and bringing in election results. The Marcos election was stolen on mainframes. You can see that on a PBS series, The Power Game, with Hedrick Smith, The Power Game, The Presidency, where, again, Richard Lugar, Senator Lugar, refused to back down from the Reagan administration when they were using mainframe computers to steal the election from Corazon Aquino.
Okay. And let's see who's next. Barbara.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, this is Barb Honegger. Thank you so much for your work. I did listen to the entire No Lies Radio program, you and the two other speakers. I think it was a great show. I have two questions for you. Many people in the 9/11 truth movement denigrate, for one reason or another. I happen to be on the other side of that, but they denigrate the evidence that Russia tried, at least, to influence the election against Hillary originally, and then, of course, Trump was the beneficiary of that. But regardless of how the election was stolen, my big question to you is, was the 2016 election stolen, in your opinion? And if so, based upon what major evidence? Thank you.
Yeah, I actually wrote a paper. Pippa Norris of Harvard had a pre-conference thing in the American Political Science Association, and I have a paper to this effect. I believe it's online at freepress.org. The evidence, I would suggest, there were 13 states, including, of course, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Florida, where the deviation from the exit polls, which historically are the most accurate poll, in fact, again, we use them, our State Department and USAID, which is, you know, written publications on them, is that once you get three or more standard deviations outside the expected results, it would call upon any researcher to look at the instrumentation. That is, perhaps the machines aren't recording correctly. So using the U.S. government standards, in 13 states, 12 of them which went for Trump, the one that went for Hillary Clinton was New York, and even if we gave her all the votes, took them all away and gave them to Trump outside the margin of error, she still would have won the state. But in Trump's case, statistically, it's just massively improbable that, you know, he'd win by 10,000 when the exit polls are showing Clinton winning clearly. Same thing in Wisconsin, same thing in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida. Out of the 28 states where the exit poll was examined in detail, 24 had an unexpected leap towards Trump. And again, you've seen the same pattern, particularly in the 2000 and really the 2004 election, where virtually every battleground state breaks in one direction. So you got 12 out of 13. If it was some sort of random error, it would have broke more evenly on each side. So, but Trump's picking up outside the expected norm, 24 of the states out of 28. But in 12 out of 13 states, he's so significantly outside the standard deviation. He's three or more deviations away. I mean, you're up there 99 times out of 100, but really the odds are much, much greater. It's just impossible to get those results without some sort of manipulation. And then, of course, the question is, you know, I think it's easier to look at, you know, who works for these companies. Sam Hawksett, the guy we caught putting the patches in 2004, you can go to his Facebook page. He says his goal in life, and this is the key technician in Ohio for ES&S, is to kill a liberal. So right before the liberal dies, he'll realize that he was killed by Sam Hawksett, not by a gun. I mean, the Shooptronics we used in Columbus in that election in 2004 in Franklin County, I mean, they were renamed Danaher because Ransom Shoup was caught with election rigging in Philadelphia. So this is an industry, you know, that has all sorts of questionable people in it, all sorts of ties. I mean, particularly, you know, we were able to trace people like Michael Connell, long history back to George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, the former CIA director. You know, who knows? The system is not designed to tell us. I mean, clearly the Russians wanted some interference, but the people that are really capable of doing this are the ones that, you know, own the software, that own the firmware on the machines, that own the, you know, the personal electronic devices where you stick it in the local precincts and translate it, you know, up to the central tabulator at the county level. When we were in Wisconsin, we found, you know, cellular hookups in Milwaukee, in the major county where Milwaukee lies, where someone could, in fact, you know, and they tell us, well, that's a case where they have to dial in and fix the machine, or could be used to fix the election. So I have no doubt statistically that somebody interfered because of the non-random way in comparison to the exit polls. Simply, the election would not have been certified by the United States, and there should have been a full investigation as to the bizarre patterns, why such massive deviation. And again, that never happens. As a social scientist, right, you look, there was no historical intervention with exit polls. When you're leaving a poll, you're telling how you voted, not how you plan on voting. So immediately, the old notion of a hismister, you'd immediately go and say, well, let's look at the instrumentation. Are these machines recording correctly? And we know they have a long tradition, notorious tradition of, you know, hopping, flipping. In 2004, we had the Mahoning County hop, and then we had the Franklin County fade, where you'd vote for Kerry, and the vote would fade away when you went to push the final button. And they admit to this stuff. but they just use code words, again, like calibration, or the ballot configuration wasn't correct. Like, yeah, you vote for A, you're getting candidate B. So all the statistical evidence shows that someone interfered with the election and it was stolen.
Okay, thank you. And lastly, Jonathan Mark. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for being here and doing your work. I follow you and Harvey quite a bit. Do you think coming up election, do you think there's a possibility of the Democrats trying to stop the outright theft of the election? You think it's already in the works of what they're planning to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, Harvey and I have taken the strip and flip approach. The hard work is usually done, although I did see that the Sixth Circuit overturned the purging essentially a million votes since the presidential election here in Ohio. They've been purging people who hadn't voted in the last two federal elections, which can occur in the same year if you have a special election. It used to be an eight-year period. So the stripping is in place. I think because the New York Times, 14 years or 18 years too late, has signaled that something's wrong with the election, I think the impact of the Stein count, because really she used a crack team that was put together for Hillary Clinton, who designed to use them, people like computer security expert Alex Halderman, the guy who hacked the Washington, D.C. election system when they challenged him and played the Michigan fight song. So you've got so many people out there, and now you've got very mainstream papers like Houston Chronicle talking about the flipping. Well, when Harvey and I first began to write about this kind of stuff, I mean, we were attacked as, of course, conspiracy theorists. You know, we had 500, signed affidavits of people in the largest public hearings ever held in Ohio who come forward and testified in detail how it flipped, how it repeatedly flipped. And we had people that admitted it on the record. And I think we're past that period. But I'm not sure we're past the period where the Democrats actually fight on this stuff. For whatever reason, they've been massively, even though they know. I mean, I briefed John Kerry. I briefed Harry Reid. In both cases, they indicated to me. I mean, Kerry's comment when I briefed him is, well, can we prove all this in 72 hours? Both his brother Cam and his late wife, who talked about the central tabulars, the motherboards. I mean, people knew. The guy working for Wesley Clark, John Marshall, Kerry called him up. And his key thing he wanted to know is, can I prove it in 72 hours? And you can't. They don't even have to give you any vote count. Really officially to 10 days after the election. So, instead of thinking I need to fight this, it was a question of how it will look PR. And I've also had many Democratic operatives, say, don't write about this stuff. All we need to do is get a massively high voter turnout, and they won't know how to preset the machines enough to steal the election. So, they know what's going on. I mean, everyone at a certain level in politics knows what's going on.
Well, thank you. John Hanke just did a new documentary, Is Trump for Real? And he's the one that did Dark Legacy, JFK, George Bush and the murder of John F. Kennedy. He's working on a follow-up on that, but Is Trump for Real? Shows some connection with 9/11 regarding Pence and the anthrax false flag attempt.
I live in Columbus, so I know all about Battelle in the operations of William Patrick III and Ken Allebeck and a variety of others that work for the Battelle and the government at a fairly high level.
Yeah, it always seems to be the Republicans that do the election stealing, and I think they needed to do it in 2000 to perpetrate 9/11 because they needed.
I think it was broad, you know, when you look at the provenance of it, and you go back and read, it really kind of emerged with the former CIA director George Herbert Walker Bush, as did people like Michael Connell, who died tragically when we were trying to get him to seek immunity before Congress. And, you know, and we knew he was being threatened by Karl Rove at the time. And, you know, we were writing the FBI, Justice, anyone, in hopes somebody would listen. But I think this stuff was brought in. If you read a lot of the accounts, Reagan actually looked into, you know, whether you could use computers. And early on, when Bush appeared out of nowhere, a lot of early accounts of caucus votes and primary votes. Remember the first time they really brought these machines in on any large scale is when John Sununu brings them in New Hampshire. And when Bush in 88 is running and Dole seeking it, and there's this massive shift. You know, instead of, you know, Dole winning by 7, suddenly Bush wins by 8. And no one thinks about questioning Sununu's new technology that he's brought in Manchester. Instead, they attribute it to an unforeseen groundswell. But no one, you know, was really thinking about looking at the machines, which should be the logical place social scientists look.
Huh. Well, thank you.
Okay, that was the last person in the queue, so thank you, Jonathan, and thank you very much, Robert, for lending your expertise to our education on this crucial issue.
Thank you.
It has certainly been a tutorial, to be sure, and food for thought. Thanks for sharing the time.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay,
I have a question.
We have one more brief item on the agenda. We had to postpone from last month because we ran out of time, and we really shouldn't do that again because it will become stale. But we really wanted to just take a few moments to give people who have participated in various 9/11 anniversary events around the country an opportunity to just take maybe a minute or so and let people know what transpired where you were, so that people know what's going on around what went on around the country in anniversary commemoration. So, who would like to start? Who has an anniversary event they participated in? They could. Oops, I'm sorry. Yeah, we're out of queue anymore. Okay. So, anybody that wishes to may speak. Wait a minute.
I could, Barb.
Yeah, Barb, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, the big event in New York City, again this year I produced, in this case on behalf of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. It was on September 10th, the day before the actual anniversary, and it was held in a wonderful venue. If you don't already have the links to the video that is now on YouTube, I'll send that. I don't think you do, maybe, but I'll send it to Craig again. To be posted, or would that be Cheryl, to be posted with the minutes. It was a very, very successful event. It was held at the Jefferson Market Public Library, which is the old courthouse in Greenwich Village and West Village, and it was standing room only. I would say we had at least 100 people there. I was the MC, if you will, and produced the event, and then introduced our new president of the Lawyers Committee, which is now Dave Meiswinkle, and he gave the opening address. I'm sorry, what? What? Did somebody say something? Oh, okay. Can you all hear me? Is it okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, fine. So Dave Meiswinkle spoke, and then we brought in Bill Jacoby, who is the national director of the 9/11 Truth Action Project, TAP. And he spoke, letting people know about approximately a little bit less than 20 9/11 truth vigils that were being held around the country the next day on 9/11, asking for support for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry Petition Project on World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. Then Richard Gage spoke and for about a half an hour summarized the evidence on World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 in the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry Petition. And then I introduced Matt Campbell, who came all the way from London. He spoke both at our New York City event on the 10th and also at a really great event that Richard Gage and Architects and Engineers put on at the Capitol, on the west side of the Capitol, between the Capitol Dome building and the reflecting pool on the 11th, on the afternoon. So Matt Campbell came all the way from London. He lost his brother, Joff, in World Trade Center 1 on the 106th floor on 9/11. And he gave a moving, moving speech. There were pros and cons of his address. I highly recommend that everybody watch both events. They're both on nolightsradio.org, but I'll send the direct links to both of them. So they were very, very, very successful. So that's in a nutshell. If anybody has any questions.
Anybody want to further this discussion with Barbara regarding the events in New York? Okay, well then,
this is Rich Ellifritz again, and I thought I might just add something. So I was at the events in New York City this year, and I attended the event at the library, and yeah, it was standing room only. I was lucky enough to have a seat. It was very, I think, informative for both members of the 9/11 Truth Movement and hopefully people who are outside and being introduced to the information. And I pretty much agree with everything that that Barb said. I've been going back to New York, like I said, since 2011, 13, 15, and now 18, since I was in Washington, D.C. last year. I actually had the kind of an interesting experience meeting Mr. Jacoby, because I interviewed him on in 2013 when during the memorial, I believe it was the Rethink 9/11 campaign that was putting up the billboard in Times Square. Yeah, so that was I think one of the landmarks for the movement that they were really, as far as my research goes, that was one of the big sort of events that drew in a lot of activists. There was a lot of speakers in 2013. In 2011, when I was down in I guess what's called Ground Zero, that was the largest event that I attended with 9/11 truth activists, wearing t-shirts, holding signs, chanting, just a very large number of people. This year there were far fewer people on the memorial, far fewer people engaging in street activism. And they kind of noted this in my interviews and some of the more regular people who were there. But I don't, in my professional work, I don't see that as sort of a sign of decline. What I see is more institutionalization happening, which is just a sort of a normal process for social movements that are on the path to success. And so I guess that's kind of what I wanted to contribute, is that I think I attended successful events this year in New York, and the presentations that I attended on 9/11 at the end of the day were at a church, and I honestly, I can't remember the name of the church, but Sandra Hicks was there, Mr. Jacoby was there, some of the victims, the family members of the victims of 9/11 were there at that church, giving, just very good speeches, and we all had...
Right, that was the Boston Quaker Meeting House.
Thank you.
Not Boston, New York Quaker Meeting.
Right. The Quakers, I remember the Quakers, yeah. So I just kind of wanted to add that since I've been to these memorial events, and that's kind of the way I phrase them in my own work, as memorials and not ceremonies, as some people refer to, you know, in the mainstream media. And I just, in my opinion, I thought they were signs of success. I wanted to be in D.C. again this year, but I just couldn't be. And I think that there's a lot of momentum being picked up in the institutional success. So while there are fewer street activists, I think more of the focus now is on targeting those sort of areas of society, like the federal government, that I think have an obligation and a duty to address our First Amendment rights in assembly and petitioning the government to redress the wrongs that have been done. So there's kind of my input.
Right, I agree with you. Where the movement has become more institutionalized, and the ultimate example of that are, of course, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and more recently, our Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and the good work we're doing. And it was the Lawyers Committee that sponsored the main event in New York City. That you, thank you for being there and for confirming that it was a great success. Next time, introduce yourself. I haven't met you.
Actually, Barb, you and I have met twice.
We have.
I'm
going to
say that. And but don't worry, because we only met very briefly both times, but I've had the pleasure and honor of shaking your hand. It's very brief, but I would very much enjoy an extended conversation with you, which I have not had the opportunity to have. And with everybody else who's on the line and listening and who's contributing, I do very much want to say that this is a great honor, being able to speak with you, to you, and this is a great pleasure, and I'm available through email or on social media, and so
okay.
You know, please.
Well, if you want to forward your email address to Craig, then others can contact you if you'd like that to be in the minutes. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Richard.
Okay. So this is Ken. I'd like to just recount very briefly what happened in San Antonio, Texas, on the commemoration of 9/11. The conference was called The Ship That Won't Sink, which, as you might guess, was not directly about 9/11 at all. It was about the USS Liberty. And it included a fellow named Phil Turney, who was a crew member of the USS Liberty, and gave a pretty stirring account of the events in question. However, Christopher Bolin also was a featured speaker at the conference. And I have to tell you that his presentation was outstanding and something that I really wish all of you had the opportunity to witness, because he's really outdoing himself these days. He's really honing his message and making it really, really easy for folks to connect to that historically. You can view his presentation if you're willing to pony up $10. The $10 goes to help defray the cost of the event, which put the organizer pretty far back. So if you could come up with it, you'll get your money's worth if you watch Christopher Bolin for $10 and the other speakers. They're all pretty good. But anyway, I've already sent Craig the link for that, so it'll be in a minute if you care to examine it for yourself out of the live stream. Okay? Anybody else with a 9/11 commemoration?
Yeah, this is Cheryl.
Yeah.
Greg and I went up to Maine for the fourth time to the Maine Organic Farmers Fair, where Lynn Bradbury and Dick Atlee, you know, do a table every year, a 9/11 table, and they welcomed them there, so it's really kind of neat. And we had a lot of young people that were really into 9/11, and they told us that their teachers won't even talk about it now. And, like, 9/11 came and went, and some of the students said they never even mentioned it. And I think it's because the students challenge them, and they just want to avoid that, so they don't talk about it at all. But you know, that's just my thoughts on that. And then we Dick did a presentation on the towers and stuff, and had about 30 people attend, so that was really good. And we were in competition with the keynote speaker at the time, so that was good that we got a good turnout anyway. And we had generally a really good turnout. Some people loved us so much they came back every day and they were hanging out at the table. And then there was one guy who came to the table and he kept shouting out as loud as he could that he said, "Prove you're not Russian agents. Prove you're not Russian agents." And I couldn't get him to stop. So finally I said to him, "Prove you're not a Mossad agent." And then he laughed.
Great.
But anyway, I think we reached a ton of people and it was very successful.
Okay. Any other commemorative events worth noting?
Is Richard Gage still on? Because the other big event was in D.C.
No, I think he's gone.
Okay.
Usually
all right. Well, I'll send the link. I'll send the link to that YouTube as well.
Okie doke. So, and now it is time for announcements. If anybody has any announcements of importance, we would like to hear them. This is your opportunity. Anybody can make an announcement?
Could you announce, please, Ken, again, how we watch the Mizuko special call, or how we, what time?
Thank you for reminding me. Yes, well, I shouldn't be doing that as an announcement, I guess. So, this is going to be scheduled for, I believe, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, 11 November. So it will just be the same deal. You'll call in, and there'll be a notification coming through the usual channel, letting you know ahead of time. But it'll be the regular conference call. The challenge for this is going to be getting Mizuko on the call. He can't afford the long distance, so I'm going to see if I can't hook him up and use Skype myself and hook him up on Skype to keep the cost down, and drag him in through my Skype. As like a conference thing. I think it can be done. I think it's been done before. Although, unfortunately, we have had problems with Skype internationally. However, he won't be the one who's doing the calling, so it might work out okay, I hope.
No, you're not saying that we all have to be on Skype. We just call the regular number and access.
No. You just call the regular number.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to figure out how to get him on the call affordably, because he can't afford the long-distance charges. So that's
right.
Well,
I want to encourage everybody to watch American Moon. Now, if you could, it is not available on YouTube. So people have to purchase it, if I understand correctly. Isn't that right?
That is correct. However, once you purchase it, you are free to make copies and to distribute them. He gets explicit
right.
permission for that, okay? But he does not want it posted online, and it will not be online. If it shows up online, he's going to drag it off because he's trying to recover his costs, okay?
Right.
So it's only,
well, I
it's
highly
only,
recommend
only
that people purchase it. From
yeah, it's
Amazon.
Only $19 on Amazon, and it's well worth
yeah.
the price, trust me.
It's well worth it. It's a must-see. It
yep,
really
is.
It is.
Okay, any other announcements?
Just to remind people of the JFK conferences, I'll send the link to those.
Yes, please
they're
do that. Robert.
They're November 16th to 18th in Dallas.
Yeah, I just might head up there myself and give you that opportunity to pay me back the drink you owe me.
All right, well, Bonnie will be there along with me and Jane Clark, so you can.
Yeah, okay.
We'll all take you out.
Okay. All right.
Oh, just
any
just
other
Bonnie, I just wanted to say I didn't mention the 9/11 Film Festival that it takes place at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland every single year. So it happened again this year. But that's something that is done every single
mm-hmm.
September 11th, if they can get
mm-hmm.
the theater on the 11th. The only thing, to my mind, that was really significant about it is that Kevin Barrett did show up, and he did talk about the censorship of Guns and Butter, which was, that was delightful. So I just wanted to mention that. That happens every single year.
Uh-oh. So, any other announcements?
Just so that people know, the link I will be sending you, you'll also be able to watch the entire 9/11 Film Festival that Bonnie just mentioned that she emceed.
Okay. Over the plan. Any other announcements? Well, hearing none, we normally would discuss future teleconferences, but Cheryl, I think we're probably okay for next time around, right? Things are looking pretty good, right?
I have some thoughts. I haven't invited anybody yet, but yeah, I think we're in. There's room if people want to get on, but let me know soon. Otherwise, I'll pursue who I have in mind.
Remember that our deadline now for teleconference items is a week prior to the teleconference. So be sure to get them in to Cheryl ASAP if you have something you'd like to do at the next teleconference or you have an idea you'd like to pursue. Okay. All right. I think that's it for tonight. It's been probably a record-breaking length of call, but we had a pretty packed agenda, and I think y'all would agree that the content was worth hanging around for. So that said, we'll see you last Wednesday. Oh, no, sorry. We'll see you on the 11th, if you can make it, on Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. Eastern. And otherwise, the last Wednesday of November will be our next regular call. So see y'all then. Have a good next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.